You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's a continuation of The Godfather Presidency by Sam Tenenhouse. Gangster romance was also at the center of political life in New York. The mobster social clubs, El Caribe in Brooklyn, the Revenite Social Club in Little Italy, the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club in Ozone Park, Queens, acquired the same dark mystique, compounded by secrecy, danger, power, and violence that had accrued 100 years earlier and that emanates from Trump and his followers today. In fact, the two power centers were fused together. Tammany-controlled politicians and the mobsters controlled Tammany Hall. The man sometimes described as Trump's favorite politician, the Brooklyn Democratic boss Meade Esposito, reportedly had a secret partner, the Lucchese boss Paul Vario, the capo in Nicholas Pileggi's Wise Guy, the basis of Scorsese's Goodfellas. Politicians, not all politicians, but lots of them, needed help here and there, Vario's protege Henry Hill told Pileggi. They got free storefront offices. They got the buses and sound systems they needed. They got the rank-and-file workers from the unions to petition when they needed it, and they got lawyers to help them poll watch. You think politicians aren't grateful? You think they don't remember their friends? The man behind it all was Esposito's pal Vario, the wise guy, someone few Poles ever saw face to face. But in Pileggi's telling, everyone owed Paulie. This all put together by businessmen connected to Paul, by lawyers indebted to Paulie, by building contractors, trucking company bosses, union guys, wholesale butchers, accountants, and people who work for the city. All the kinds of upstanding people who are totally legit. But behind it all is usually a wise guy like Paulie waiting for his payday. Illicit power required high arts of concealment. Paulie ran the whole thing in his head, Hill recalled. He didn't take any notes. He never wrote anything down, and he never made a phone call unless it was from a booth. And then he'd only make an appointment for later. There were hundreds of guys who depended upon Paulie for their living. But he never paid out a dime. All they got from Paulie was protection from other guys looking to rip them off. The wise guys divide whatever you stole for their own pockets. These are the practices that Trump, so undisciplined in so many other ways, mastered. It is what excited his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, who grew up knowing mobsters through El Caribe, the pool club in Mill Basin, owned by Cohen's uncle and a popular mob hangout in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Cohen worked at the club in his teens and 20s, and was excited to find in Trump a boss who imported the same brashness and thug toughness to Manhattan boardrooms, with Cohen himself in the enforcer role of designated hardass. In his memoir, Disloyal, Cohen deconstructs Trump's Paulie style of bossism. He used inferences, nods, silences, euphemisms, signals. It was similar to how Trump never used email for the simple reason that it created a digital fingerprint that would permanently record his words and thus potentially ensnare him. Like a crime boss, Trump wanted no evidence that could connect him to any of his deeds or deeds that he indirectly or directly ordered others to do. Trump's mind was so permeated with deception and delusion of others, but also of himself, that I had to be prepared to literally depart from reality and enter into a kind of fantasy land when I spoke with the president. Boss Esposito was but one of many connections Trump cultivated in his New York years, and one of many indicted for mob connections captured on wiretaps by the then fanatically righteous crime buster Rudolph Giuliani. Another of the era's culprits was Donald Manus, the president of Trump's home borough, Queens, who committed suicide after he was caught in a parking racket stealing quarters out of parking meters, as Galway says with a laugh. Manus's main confederate was Stanley Friedman, the law partner of Trump's mentor, the tough-as-nails attorney Roy Cohn. Friedman was also the Bronx Democratic Party boss and later deputy mayor, until he was convicted and sent to jail on bribery and kickback charges in 1987. 10 years earlier, it was Friedman who secured the president and logic-defying decades-long tax abatement that made possible Trump's first great project, the remodeling of the decrepit Commodore adjacent to Grand Central into the first Trump Hotel. These were the kingpins who controlled New York politics in the 1970s and 80s, the time of Trump's early New York conquest. That is the America he yearns to make great again, the America of his youth. Trump, too, feels less like an autocrat's attempt to recreate, say, Mussolini's Italy, than a plan to scale up five-borough bossism. The methods and ambitions seem plain. The law of vengeance, and also the payoffs that come with fealty and protection. Not to mention, thanks to Trump's friends in Qatar, the offer of a super luxury Air Force One, a flashy aeronautical pimpmobile that turned out to be a 13-year-old cast-off. The pattern was established under Trump One. It was the life of lies, as former FBI Director James Comey would describe it in 2018 in his book, A Higher Loyalty. Comey's years prosecuting mobsters in the 1980s and 90s were prelude to his dealings with Trump and those around him. The silent circle of ascent was the same, as was the feeling of the boss in complete control. "Holy crap," Comey recalls after an early meeting with Trump. "They are trying to make each of us an amica nostra, a friend of ours." Trump first wooed Comey, then vilified him, then summarily fired him, and followed it all with a prolonged campaign of abuse, harassment, and intimidation that included an extensive IRS audit. Not to mention this past May, when Comey was interrogated by the Secret Service after posting an Instagram photo of beach shells spelling out 8647, social media code for removing Trump from office. The question we should be asking is not why this president thinks he can do this, but why so many people outside of New York City, voters numbering in the tens of millions, seem to agree. The Trump of his own golden age was schooled by the Trump of the 40s and 50s, his father. When Barrett, Donald's tenacious biographer, asked Esposito what he knew about Fred Trump, Esposito had a curt and unusual response. "He was my friend Willie Tomasello's partner." Tomasello was a mobster connected to both the Gambino and Genovese families, and the partnership had been formed during the late 1940s, when New York's mayor was William O'Dwyer, and as Barrett writes, having a mob-connected partner was a way of doing business in New York. O'Dwyer, a former New York City cop, abruptly announced his retirement in 1950 to accept a position as President Harry Truman's ambassador to Mexico. It soon emerged that Truman had given O'Dwyer the plum post to get him out of the country and spare him from incrimination in an emerging Brooklyn rackets scandal. Seen through today's headlines, Truman's O'Dwyer reassignment neatly foreshadows the Trump Justice Department's intervention to protect New York's currently embattled mayor, Eric Adams. Like O'Dwyer, a former cop, who was rescued when he became embroiled in corruption charges. Truman's intervention was a mystery at the time. As far as anyone knew, he didn't like O'Dwyer, just as Trump doesn't seem to like Adams particularly much. Then again, Truman had powerful illicit connections, too, with the Pendergast machine in Kansas City, which imposed its will at election time through what David McCulloch in Truman says were strong-arm tactics at the polls, ballot stuffing, ballot box theft, the buying of votes with whiskey or cash, bloody, headlong street brawls, all the odious stratagems that had made big city politics notorious since the time of Boss Tweed. New York remained the capital of bossist politics. It persisted through the 70s and 80s, through the mayoralties of Abe Beam and Ed Koch. Little wonder that Giuliani, who rose to fame in part by prosecuting Manus, should become a consigliere to Boss Trump. In this, he is merely reversing the familiar script of the criminal who flips to the other side, or the prosecutor who finds greater, or at least more lucrative, rewards in defending the criminally accused. This is the world Trump came of age in. More accurately, the world in which he really did achieve great things, and it's no surprise he wishes to bring it back. On its own terms, it all works. The examples abound. From the radio demagogue Father Coughlin in the 1930s to the Black Panther leader Eldridge Cleaver in the 1960s, strong and distinctly American voices have advocated for religious, racial, or political violence. In literary circles, the sage of underworld democracy was Norman Mailer, whose work was filled with tabloid pictures of the darkening American dream. "Americans have been leading a double life," he wrote in 1960, "and our history has moved on two rivers, one visible, the other underground. There has been the history of politics, which is concrete, factual, practical, and unbelievably dull. And there is a subterranean river of untapped, lonely, and romantic desires, that concentration of ecstasy and violence, which is the dream life of the nation." Mailer wrote this in the excited aftermath of the 1960 Democratic Convention in Los Angeles and its nomination of a libertine mob-connected sexual predator, John F. Kennedy, whose playground included the Palm Beach compound owned by his financier father, 5 miles up South Ocean Boulevard from where Mar-a-Lago now stands. JFK's career in the House and Senate had been lackluster, but he had the looks and style of a potential existential hero, Mailer wrote, a Hollywood-style good-bad loner in the mold of Cagney and Bogart, Brando and Sinatra, with his strutter's vow to love well and love many, be cool, be daring, be dashing, be wild, be wily, be resourceful, be a brave gun. Fanboy imagery aside, Mailer was right. Ecstasy and violence did, in fact, follow. Violence by white sheriffs against civil rights demonstrators in Oxford, Mississippi, and Birmingham, Alabama. Assassinations commissioned by the Kennedy administration with the help of the CIA and the mafia. Silent coups. In sum, a White House-directed murder incorporated, as Kennedy's successor, Lyndon Johnson, said after the existential hero himself was slain in Dallas in a climax of ecstasy and violence. A climax achieved much sooner than even Mailer had supposed. Mailer's essay was titled Superman Comes to the Supermarket. In those years, the supermarket was the transactional bazaar and also the national newsstand. On the racks near checkout counters, supermen were to be found on the front pages of the newspapers and covers of magazines published by the nation's press lords. But again, there was a second stream. The most democratic of all American newspapers, the true vox populi for generations, avidly read by Trump, was the National Enquirer. We all heard about the Enquirer during Trump's hush money trial last year, but little was said about its powerful imprint on American politics and culture. reportedly founded with New York mob money, the Inquirer, accompanied some 50 years later by its conjoined twin, Rupert Murdoch's Star, transformed journalism from the 70s to the 90s through stories of illicit sexual liaisons. And through the hidden system of blackmail its creators practiced to keep stories out of print, the catch and kill discussed at Trump's trial. The same tabloids trafficked in conspiracy theories as well, widening the chinks in the wall between reality and fantasy, between news and nonsense. The publications also provided key hires for the original staff of Murdoch's New York Post and Fox News. In those years, Inquirer-style journalism crept ever closer to the mainstream. One reason Trump so blithely accuses the legacy media of fostering lies is his own successful history in using reputable publications to circulate falsehoods of his own. Best sex I've ever had. In Trump's critical first years in Manhattan real estate, the best publicity he got came in the pages of the Times, one flattering story after another on Fred Trump and his wunderkind son, the potential savior of Manhattan. Long before Make America Great Again had come the romantic campaign, part flimflam, part pay-for-play deal-making, to make Manhattan Oz again. There was a belated instance of what Nathaniel Hawthorne had discerned all those years ago, the magnetizing effect on statesmen and magistrates, the guardians, the respected voices within the influential classes who joined the inner circle round about the gallows. Now, of course, the price of all this is coming true. The president as celebrity, the tranced reporting of White House gossip, all of it soaked in the excitements of the tabloids of old, and finding newer life on the dark recesses of the web today, have always had a more chilling subtext, a retribution and exacted payment of the favor expected in return. It was ever thus. The Puritans' howling wilderness included a shadowy fever swamp from the start, the historian Stacy Schiff has written in this magazine, comparing MAGA world with nefarious pre-colonial forces. Conspiracies invite the arsonist to shout fire. It turns mobs into martyrs. There is a bravado to it, without which it deflates into opera buffa. It is exhilarating on what seems to be a rational level. The pulse quickens as the pieces click into place. Nearly 3.5 centuries after Plymouth Colony was first settled, another historian, Richard Hofstadter, would describe a parallel fanaticism, labeling it the paranoid style in American politics. Gans notes a second connection, the affinities between classic dictatorship and gangland rule. In both cases, it's about getting a piece of the action. Power is domination. Both also nurture zero-sum attitudes toward the world, and they make for natural partnerships. Vladimir Putin and Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, even as they may seek to manipulate Trump, feel a genuine kinship with him. Fascists believe in some kind of national project. Over and above the petty instincts of the gangster, says Gans, but at the same time, the gangsters see their own advantage. The two use each other. The difference is that Trump's superpower depends finally on his supporters. He needs the Democratic mob to pursue his own mobster-style ends. There, too, he is an innovator. He has taken the existential idea beyond Mailer's romantic visions of the lone gunman. Mailer's fantasies grew out of old Hollywood and the TV Western, the solo actor and anti-hero acting on his own. Social media in our day has brought us back to the original idea of the mob that Hawthorne gave us. People, lots of them, brought together in collective ecstasy, but also despair. The great majority of the MAGA millions want what most of us do, a shot at the American dream, which they feel Trump's policies might help them realize. The same promise made by the Tammany Clubmen of old. Others, the faithful, believe that last July, the president was literally saved from assassination by divine intervention. Still others are mischief makers, the doxers and swatters, the armed-to-the-teeth patriots. Each occupies a place in the great democratic panorama. But there is also an unsanctioned force that the president has managed to assemble, one that is unique in American history. It is a network, and it is not unlike the vigilante militias Puzo described as a second and more powerful government. The prescient observer of American gangsterism nearly a century ago was the novelist and later screenwriter Daniel Fuchs, who grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, close by Al Capone's old stomping grounds, in a time when New York's poorer neighborhoods were fields of combat for youth gangs. In 1931, when Capone was already the most famous of all mobsters, the virtual monarch of Chicago, at last brought down on tax evasion charges, Fuchs reflected on the route Capone had traveled from boy gang member to adult gangster. The young Capone had been utterly unlike the terrifying criminal of the Prohibition era, a nonentity, affable, soft of speech. Capone was one of many, Fuchs wrote, who had been able to use their boy gangs as a training school for later organized adult gangsterism, in most cases completing their records in jails, in gangs, in rackets and in graves, prosperous and poor, famous and unsung. Trump grasped the latent potential of those other ordinary people, most of them young men, members of the manosphere, who can be mobilized into a force. He tapped into this in the days and months leading up to the attack on the Capitol on January 6, 2021, and upon taking office, he pardoned more than 1,500 of them. They form one faction. He has also signed an executive order intended to allow the American military to perform police functions and granting police immunity from prosecution. He has enlisted law firms to promise to do pro bono work defending cops against accusations of strong-arm behavior. As the Trump administration goes after attorneys and judges, opponents and enemies, real and perceived, one truly twisted idea still resonates. It is an idea he'd proposed during the campaign. It is an idea that would have given even Mailer a jolt. We need, said candidate Trump, one really violent day to eradicate crime immediately. Nominally, he was calling for a frenzied few hours in which police could have their way with shoplifters and others. But he was also summoning, in the minds of many, visions of Kristallnacht, of the bloody police crackdown outside the 1968 Democratic Convention, of Pat Buchanan's war whoop at the 1992 Republican Convention when he discussed how the National Guard had restored order after the L.A. riots. The troopers came up the street, M-16s at the ready, and the mob threatened and cursed, but the mob retreated because it had met the one thing that could stop it, force, rooted in justice and backed by moral courage. Consider one really violent day in the context of recent actions, deportations, detentions defying court orders about immigration policies, and recent propositions reopen Alcatraz, expand Guantanamo, ship migrants to Libya and Rwanda, and one sees the possible groundwork for the ultimate in power politics, the potential contours of a police state. Amid the Doge deluge, people's tax records and Social Security information and other data were shared with unauthorized authorities. Amid the restructuring of the executive branch, Trump took charge of two previously independent agencies, the NSA and the FBI. In advance of the nationwide hands-off protest in April, security teams put up anti-scaling fencing around the White House. Timed to coincide with his birthday in June, Trump scheduled a full-on military parade. Since January, he has declared 8 national emergencies, from the emergency on the southern border to the fossil fuel emergency. This is the mentality of an outlaw, one well-versed in the legal extremes of martial law, in part because he just might need his enforcers in an emergency. Like FDR before him, Trump has blundered into error. Time and again, the courts, including the Supreme Court, have told him to desist, though they have no power of enforcement. There has been wreckage all along the way. But he also has achieved something no one else has. He has brought Tammany mob rule to the pinnacle of American politics and power. Even the mighty Capone was brought down by the government. Trump, in contrast, has made the executive branch, indeed the 3 branches of U.S. government, his. And he has done so swiftly, effectively, and in a manner that makes him, to use a Prohibition-era phrase applied to Elliot Ness, the G-man who pursued the country's most menacing gangsters, for now, at least, untouchable. As for the fallout from all of this, that's entirely another matter. Star Witness. Nearly a decade after Kim Kardashian was robbed at gunpoint, Her emotional testimony in a Paris courtroom helped convict her attackers. By Hugo Winterbert. Opening photo. Kardashian in Paris, the day of the robbery. Police outside the Hotel de Portales after the robbery. The hotel in the 8th arrondissement caters almost exclusively to the rich and famous. And in other photos, Kim Kardashian sitting front row with her mother, Kris Jenner, at the Givenchy show on October 2, 2016. Kim Kardashian had only one desire, to flee as quickly as she could. "I want to leave and be reunited with my children in the United States," she said. "A private plane is waiting for me at Le Bourget." It wasn't that simple. Investigators from the Paris police's organized crime department still had a few questions to ask her. It was 4:30 a.m. on October 3, 2016, and they were at her hotel to take her statement. The 35-year-old American star appeared distraught, in shock, very pale, and she wasn't wearing any makeup, they noted. An hour and a half earlier, two men, one of them armed, burst into her suite of the Hotel de Portales, a stone's throw from the Madeleine Church in the heart of the city. At first, she believed she was dealing with terrorists, as she put it. "I thought they were going to shoot me. When I realized that the gun was real, I decided to do whatever they ask." Kardashian told investigators the men demanded her jewelry, then bound her and duct-taped her mouth before carrying her into the bathroom. Her nightmare lasted about 10 minutes. "I had an indecipherable feeling, like my heart was coming out of my chest," she said. "I knew I was going to die." She also explained to the police that she wasn't able to see much of her assailants, who were masked. One must have been close to 5'11", and the other was between 5'7 and 5'9". The investigator seized a number of items that the thieves might have touched for DNA testing. They took samples from Kardashian's wrist, ankles, and hair. At 7:40 a.m., she was allowed to depart on her private jet. Soon, the global media would arrive at the hotel. In late April, almost a decade later, 10 defendants in the case appeared before the Paris Assize Court. Three of the defendants, suspected of having broken in the Hotel de Portales to rob Kardashian, were by then between 68 and 71 years old. One wore a hearing aid. Another had difficulty walking. They were tried for their alleged part in one of the most audacious robberies of recent decades, with an estimated haul valued between $6 million and $10 million. The trial presented two spectacularly different worlds. On one side, the global star, one of the most famous and photographed women in the world, whose social media abetted rise to fame, represented an entirely new brand of celebrity. On the other, a gang of mostly repeat offenders, many past their prime. There was a California woman with an almost inconceivable fortune on one hand, and a motley crew of criminals largely from the poor suburbs of Paris on the other. Most of the accused denied any wrongdoing. Two of them provided limited confessions, taking care not to implicate others, and explained that some statements they provided were the result, in part, of being overwhelmed by events. The accused burglars had also been approached by American documentary producers and major Parisian publishers eager to share their stories. One agreed. He made the rounds of TV studios, facing the wrath of his supposed accomplices. According to his account, he didn't know who Kardashian was before targeting her. Patricia Tourangeau, who met most of the accused while writing Kim et les Papis Braqueur, Kim and the Grandpa Robbers, pointed out, "What struck me was their casualness. They're very experienced, but at the same time, there was something amateur about the operation. They certainly had good intelligence, but they also operated by instinct." Kardashian has rarely spoken publicly about her ordeal. By all appearances, the episode remains a source of trauma for her, but one she was prepared to revisit on the stand. It could be an incredible moment in court, one Parisian defense lawyer told me before the trial, excited at the prospect. Next photos, Kim, Kourtney Kardashian, and Kanye West on September 29, 2016. Kim Kardashian and bodyguard in Paris on October 2, 2016. And the ring targeted during the robbery, which has never been recovered. The story starts with Elmar Ait Kadeshi. He arrived in France from Algeria at the age of 7 and grew up in Corbeil-en-Parisis, northwest of Paris, in a public housing development surrounded by open fields. He dabbled in petty theft from an early age, logging his first arrest at 14. He was sent to the juvenile section of the Evreux prison. Convictions for increasingly more serious crimes followed. Robberies, muggings, and other acts of violence led to more frequent prison stays. Around 2010, the authorities lost track of Ait Kadeshi when he disappeared to avoid a 5-year sentence for drug possession and trafficking. Eventually, he resurfaced and could often be found in the capital's bistros, boasting of his exploits, even if his age and physical condition had curtailed his criminal activity. The former marathon runner is now half deaf and wears thick glasses. Around spring 2016, a group of men were smoking Itanis and sipping Ricard in a bar in the Marais district. It was then Ait Kadeshi heard about the wife of a famous rapper who regularly visits Paris during fashion weeks. She always had her jewelry with her, a fortune in diamonds that she displayed on social media. The person who gave him this tip assured him that he has a solid source in Kardashian's entourage during her visits to Paris. Every time she came to the city, she stays in a luxurious apartment hotel that doesn't have the same levels of security as some other hotels. On paper, it sounded like a very simple operation to Ait Kadeshi, whom prosecutors alleged was the plot's ringleader, a charge he always denied. At that moment, Ait Kadeshi didn't know who Kardashian was, but he appreciated his future target's array of jewels, including a ring set with an 18.8-carat diamond given to her earlier that year by her husband, Kanye West. Its value is estimated at 4 million euros. According to the prosecution, Ait Kadeshi set to work assembling a team for the heist. All were trusted friends, mostly around his age, whom he met over the years in various Paris bistros. He also carried out the initial scouting to verify the low level of security at the hotel. He pushed open the gate, no key or code necessary, to enter a paved courtyard filled with statues. There's a museum open to the public, and at the far end is the Hotel de Portales. The only challenge, you can't reach the building by car. The robbers would have to get away on bikes. In June 2016, Kardashian and West traveled to Paris. The burgeoning heist team considered pulling off their robbery then, but decided against it. They were not yet ready, and Kardashian was too often surrounded by photographers. It was better to be patient, they decided, and continue to build out their ranks. According to investigators, Didier Dubrock joined them. Known as Didier Les Yeux Bleus, Didier Blue Eyes, he was an underemployed plumber and enthusiast of Côte d'Aron wines with a dozen criminal convictions. He'd spent 23 years of his life in prison for theft, on drug charges, and for robberies, and now his head rings with tinnitus after living with the constant noise of detention centers. An old friend of Ait Kadeshi's, Yunus Abbas, would also join the operation. Abbas had spent almost 2 decades in prison since his first conviction in 1972. When his friend told him about a job stealing the jewelry of the wife of a famous rapper, he hesitated. He didn't want to end up back behind bars. Besides, with his heart condition, he couldn't see himself committing a robbery that required escaping by bike. But he also owed his friend 3,500 euros, and the fear of missing out on what could be one of the biggest heists of the decade finally convinced him. Next photos, Kendall Jenner and Hailey Baldwin, now Hailey Bieber, arrive at the hotel after the robbery, and a suspect in the robbery after their arrest in January 2017. The opportunity presented itself that fall during one of Paris's fashion weeks. Kardashian landed at 10:40 a.m. on September 28, 2016, in a private jet at Le Bourget Airport. She was accompanied by her sister Courtney, her mother, Kris Jenner, an assistant, a stylist, and a bodyguard. A phalanx of photographers followed her, though they dispersed each time she returned to her Parisian residence, the Hôtel de Portales. The luxurious mansion in the 8th arrondissement catered almost exclusively to the rich and famous, and ideally guessed to fit both of those descriptions. Madonna and Beyoncé and Jay-Z have slept there. Prince bought out the entire hotel for a party in 2010. Soccer star Zlatan Ibrahimovic lived there for a year. Kardashian and West were regulars. They honeymooned there after they were married in 2014. There are 11 tastefully decorated apartments, with prices ranging from 1,000 to 15,000 euros per night. Kardashian settled into one of the most luxurious suites, the Garden Duplex. It measures more than 3,950 square feet. She was in and out between stops around the city, a fitting at Balmain with Olivier Rousteing, lunch at a restaurant off of Avenue Montaigne, and many fashion shows. On Sunday, October 2nd, she sat front row at Riccardo Tisci's show for Givenchy and the Jardin des Plantes. Later, she headed back to the suite with her sister to change, then on to the Azzedine Alaïa showroom for a private dinner. Bianca Jagger and architect Peter Marino were among the guests, who dined on scrambled eggs with truffles and Saint-Honoré cakes, washed down with Louis VIII cognac from Maison Remy Martin. Then it was back to the hotel around midnight in a black Mercedes van. Kim decided not to join Courtney, who was going clubbing at L'Arc just off of Champs-Élysées. Their shared bodyguard went with her. Instead, Kim returned to her room with her stylist, put on a bathrobe, lay down on her bed, and started watching a documentary on her laptop. Abderrahmane Outiki, a 39-year-old student from northern Algeria, was working as the night concierge one floor down. He was mostly paid not to fall asleep and was fighting boredom by studying for a doctorate in semiology and discourse analysis at the Sorbonne. At 2:22 a.m., he was talking to a friend on Skype when someone knocked on the hotel door. In fact, there were three people at the entrance, dressed as police officers. Outiki wasn't concerned. Complaints of disturbances happen occasionally, though oddly, these officers were hooded. As soon as he opened the door, he was confronted by an automatic pistol, handcuffed and forced to his knees. "We're here for the money," shouted one of the assailants. "Who's in the hotel?" another demanded. The concierge offered a vague reply. "Fashion people, it's fashion week." During a brief moment of hesitation, he wondered who the criminals were really after. "The rapper's wife, where is she?" one assailant asked. Outiki led two of the robbers to Kardashian's room at gunpoint. Next photos, Eunice Abbas, who co-authored the book I Kidnapped Kim Kardashian with his lawyer in April, and Kardashian at the Paris courthouse for testimony in May. Kardashian thought she heard her sister coming home from the club and uttered an unanswered hello. Then she saw two men in police uniforms arrive, carrying the handcuffed concierge. Kardashian at first thought she was dealing with terrorists, panicked, and dialed 911, the emergency number in the United States. She didn't reach help, The police equivalent of 911 in France is 17. She then tried to call her bodyguard, but the robbers grabbed the star's BlackBerry. Then again, they appeared to hesitate. What were their intentions? For 5 long minutes, the most terrible minutes, the reality TV star later explained to police, the room was plunged into an unbearable suspense. Then finally, the hooded men called out, "La ring, la ring," with their thick accents. The American didn't understand them. "What? What?" she asked. The thieves mimed the gesture of a groom slipping a wedding ring onto the finger of his bride. She still didn't get it. "I think they want your ring," the concierge suggested, Kardashian would later recall. He was still a hostage, but also now a negotiator and interpreter. Kardashian pointed to the solitaire on her bedside table. But the thieves wanted more. "Money, money, money," one of them shouted. Kardashian had just $1,000 in her wallet, a disappointment for the thieves. She was distraught and cried, asking loudly, "Are we going to die? Tell them not to kill me. I have children." One of the assailants then took it upon himself to tie up the star. Meanwhile, his accomplice grabbed as much jewelry as he could. Just as they were about to move on to another room, Kardashian's phone started ringing. The concierge later explained to a police officer that he warned the thieves. "Do you know who's calling?" he asked them. "It's her bodyguard. If she doesn't answer, he'll arrive." Quickly, the victim was left in the bathroom, and eventually the thieves disappeared on their bikes. Although the robbery was cut short, the haul, including the 18.8-carat ring, a yellow-gold Rolex Cosmograph Daytona, 7 Cartier and Hermes bracelets, and 3 gold and diamond grills, exceeded the thieves' expectations. It could have been even more. As he fled, one of the thieves fell off his bike, spilling jewelry onto the sidewalk. That same morning, a local woman on her way to work came across a sumptuous pendant on the ground, wearing it all day long to the amazement of her colleagues. In the evening, she returned home, only to hear about the burglary. After some internet sleuthing, she learned the value of the 3.5-carat jewel she'd found, $33,180. The next day, she turned it into the local police station. Given the victim's state of shock, the investigators quickly ruled out insurance fraud. They were, however, suspicious of the night concierge. Could he have been part of an inside job, leading the thieves to the loot? Why would he open the door to hooded individuals? The cameras installed in the hotel were not operating that evening, so it was impossible to confirm parts of his account. Uatiki, after being questioned at length and having spent 36 hours without sleep, finally went free, but his phone was tapped. The investigators were immediately under pressure. The case was sensitive, and the image of Paris, already badly damaged by the wave of terrorist attacks the previous year, was at stake. They began by retrieving images from surveillance cameras near the hotel that showed some of the alleged thieves leaving by bicycle. 4 days after the robbery, there was a break. Despite the gloves worn by the thieves, DNA was found on the rolls of tape used to tie up Kardashian and also on the cable used to restrain the concierge. This DNA was eventually traced back to a man called Pascal. At the same time, investigators found several burner phones. They discovered that Pascal was in fact an alias used by Ait Kadeshi, whom they began to track. Within a few weeks, police realized that the owner of a bar Ait Kadeshi frequented was close to the brother of the driver that Kardashian regularly hired when she visited Paris. The widening ring of suspects, unaware their phones were now tapped, talked about the heist among themselves. They expressed annoyance at not getting the money they expected from the robbery, and their loot was hard to unload. The police had a front-row seat for the gang's activities. According to later reports, Ait Kadeshi put pressure on a certain Nez Rapé, Rough Nose, suspected of being the fence for the goods and entrusted with selling the jewels in Antwerp. but selling a ring like Kardashian's is not easy. Generally, thieves recover only a very small fraction of a piece's market value, 10 to 15%, once all the intermediaries have been paid. Authorities made their first arrest in the case on January 9, 2017, 3 months after the robbery, taking 17 people into custody early in the morning. They were almost all repeat offenders: a Mirai Bistro owner, the limo driver, the fence. Of the 10 defendants who would eventually face charges, most were over 60 years old, and at first, all of them denied any involvement with the crime. But two came under particular pressure from the police. First, Ike Kadeshi. At his home, the police found 16,900 euros in his refrigerator. He claimed to be able to explain, but then struggled to do so when the investigators told him that his DNA was found in Kardashian's bedroom. Although he denied robbing her, he finally broke down and confessed to having played a small role in the affair. The second was Abbas, Ait Kadeshi's old friend, who was quicker to confess. The investigator found almost 60,000 euros in small bills at his son's house, and his DNA was also at the hotel. Abbas says his role was merely to stay on the first floor of the Hotel de Portales and keep watch. What about the others? They all denied the evidence against them. Take Dubrec, Didier Blue Eyes, for example. He is suspected of being the second hooded man to have entered the suite. But he insisted that he was the victim of a combination of circumstances, having merely been an acquaintance of Ait Kadeshi, whom he used to call Pascal. Even so, an individual on CCTV images bore a resemblance to him, and the police also said he had one of the burner phones. "I only have peace phones," he joked in a book interview, playing off the French phrase for a burner phone, portable de guerre, or war mobile. Dubrec presented himself as an innocent father. Dubrec spent nearly 11 months in pretrial detention, only to be released to receive chemotherapy for lung cancer. Abbas, after quadruple bypass surgery and getting a new heart valve, spent 22 months in pretrial detention. Ait Kadeshi was the last to be released in April 2020 due to the COVID pandemic. He returned to prison only a year later, after a police check unearthed the outstanding 5-year sentence for drug trafficking. Abbas, Dubrec, and Ait Kadeshi were all charged with a criminally organized robbery at gunpoint and sequestration and faced life imprisonment. "My client will assume responsibility for his part in the crime," said Gabriel Dumanil. Abbas's lawyer before the trial. According to Dumanil, Abbas couldn't wait for the process to be over, though his client didn't make it easy for himself. Abbas co-wrote a 2021 book about the affair, J'ai séquestré Kim Kardashian, I kidnapped Kim Kardashian. It was like shooting himself in the foot, confessing to more than he was accused of, and perhaps even more than he actually did. Was it driven by a sudden desire for fame or money, or both? Perhaps Abbas felt he'd be seen as a hero, as some sort of Robin Hood. In a newspaper interview, he explained how he enjoyed favorable treatment in prison from other inmates. "Some of them would pat me on the back and congratulate me. 'You did a good job. Well done.' I'd say, 'Yeah, well, I ended up here with you, so I don't see what the big deal is.' Strangers began to recognize him on the street and ask for selfies. And then Abbas became disillusioned with it all. At the request of the hotel concierge's lawyers, the copyright to his book was seized by the courts. In June 2017, Ait Kadeshi wrote something of his own, a letter to Kardashian. 'After witnessing your emotions and realizing the psychological damage I have inflicted on you, I decided to write, not in the hope you will forgive me, but as a human who wishes to tell you how much I regret what I did and how moved I was when I saw you in tears. 4 months after the robbery, a French judge traveled to the U.S. to question Kardashian. She said she had been transformed by the trauma and had become less materialistic after the robbery. My perception of jewelry is that I don't care about it like I used to. I don't have the same feelings about it. In fact, I feel like it's become a burden to be responsible for such expensive items. No object of sentimental value can compare with coming home to your children, your family. On a Tuesday in May of this year, Kardashian arrived at the Paris courthouse in a cinched black dress designed by Jean Galliano and vertigo-inducing pumps. She accessorized with a necklace of gems around her neck and a dazzling ring. She was accompanied by her mother and 5 bodyguards with earpieces. It was the 3rd week of the trial, and a few yards away was Ait Kadeshi, now 69, but looking 15 years older, his arrival announced by the clanking of his cane. The dozens of reporters covering the proceedings watched as Kardashian testified that she had come to let her truth be heard about the night that traumatized her. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.